Hello and welcome Behind the Marquee, the podcast where we talk about movies and what's going on at behind the scenes at the Michigan Theater. My name is Nick, and I'm the programming and media coordinator with the Michigan Theater Foundation, and I'm joined by two guests. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Anna Baumgart, and I'm the writer and director and one of the producers of Disfluency.
And I'm Danny Mooney, and I'm also a producer on Disfluency.
Thank you both for joining me and this lovely Thursday afternoon. Anna, I was looking at your IMDb, and the one that stood out to me on your producer credit, Ann Arbor Land, that was actually something that I helped out with back in that, what was that, 2013?
Yeah, that was a while ago.
Yeah.
Oh, that's yeah, awesome. That's so cool.
I have no idea what I'm credited or what I was even doing on the set there. I was helping out, but I don't know exactly what I was doing there. But that was a funny little connection that I had completely forgotten about.
Oh, I love that. That's wonderful.
Your film Disfluency, it was a part of our Cinetopia Film Festival in 2018 as a short, part of our Detroit Voices, where it won the Knight Jury Prize. Could you, let's just start out, talk about the film as a short that you adapted into a feature. Where did writing this story begin for you?
Yes. So I'll start talking about the short first.
Yeah.
So the short film and the feature are both pulled from a personal experience that I had, a personal traumatic experience. So when I went to write the short, I honestly had no intention of making it. It was just kind of my way to process what I had gone through. Mm-hmm. But I kept coming back to it, and I got to a point where I was like, okay, I got to make this, which I think is where the best stories come from, are those ideas and concepts you have that you can't get out of your head and that you keep coming back to. So I set out to make it in Los Angeles. It was just like a year or two out of school. I ended up writing and producing, and I brought on Laura Holiday, who's a friend I met in LA, on to direct. And we made the short in Los Angeles. And we did, you know, a festival run with that, and that's where we played at Cinetopia and won the jury prize, which was amazing. It was so cool to be screening a film post college back in Michigan. Mm-hmm. So that was really rewarding. And then when we went to make the short film a feature, develop it into a feature, I had gotten into this lab called the Short Feature Lab, which is run by Jim Cummings and Ben Wiesner, A Vanishing Angle. And that's where I first started to think, okay, maybe I can actually do this. But because the content was so heavy, and I knew that when you make a feature film, you spend so much time on it, I was like, okay, if I'm going to make this traumatic film, I'm also going to make it a fun summer movie, and we're going to figure that out. So that's kind of where the beginning of the journey was.
And so you did not direct the short, correct? You wrote it, but you didn't direct it. What was the decision? How did you come to the decision, I want to direct this feature?
So like a lot of directors, especially early directors, I dealt a lot with imposter syndrome and my desire to direct and feeling like I couldn't do it. And it was honestly the people around me, including Danny, was a really big part of it. You know, helping instill the confidence in me that I could direct the feature. The short, I also think I was not ready to direct it. I think I was too close to it at the time. And working with Laura, I mean, was an easy choice because I absolutely adore her. But when it came to making the feature, you know, when I was talking to Danny and Jim and Ben and Laura, there were all these conversations like, Anna, this is your story. If you want to direct, this is the time to do it. So I really just kind of like took that leap of faith. And I'm so glad that I did. It was so, so rewarding.
So Danny, you were friends. How did you come into this story?
We had crossed paths over the year, but very tangentially. But then when Anna was kind of going through the, like, do I direct it, do I not? But then also, I if I direct it, I'm going to need like a producer to really like run stuff so I can focus on directing. And that was kind of what Anna was kind of hitting a crossroads at. And so she just reached out to kind of talk it through. And I was kind of like, look, like, I agree with everyone else. Like, this is your story. Like, this really needs to be your voice for this thing. And so I was like, I'll clear out the schedule. Like, let's just make this happen. And so I kind of came on board to help her kind of bring this thing to fruition and allow her to kind of hunker in and get the space creatively to direct it. And so it was very serendipitous that it all kind of worked out that way, but I was so happy. And like, I can't, you know, picture anyone else ever directing anything like this. So it was awesome.
The Michigan setting I feel is very important to this film. I grew up on the west side of the state near Lake Michigan, so the lake life I very much understood these people and this setting. Was the film always going to be filmed in Commerce in Michigan, or did you think of it being anywhere else?
When I set out to write the script, I did what a lot of indie filmmakers do, which is look at the resources I had around me. And I also, this is a little woo-woo, but I listen to the universe a lot, and opportunities that come up, I really pay attention to, and I'm always kind of listening to things around me. And one of those things was this competition called Hometown Heroes on Seed and Spark. Hometown Heroes is run by the Duplass brothers, and it was a $40,000 grant competition. And what you had to do was run a fundraiser on Seed and Spark. Seed and Spark is very similar to Kickstarter, for those that don't know. And I saw it and I was like, Hometown Heroes. Okay, could I make this movie in my hometown? And I was like, yeah, okay. I could definitely do that. Oh, I love the idea of it being like in and around the lakes. That's really fun. That's something I would really enjoy doing. So I kind of had, it built the foundation coming to that conclusion that I was going to shoot it in my hometown. And it was shot at my parents' house, my grandmother's house, my aunt's house, the local ice cream place I went to as a kid, the local grocery store. So all of those places are the places that are very near and dear to my heart. And I also had access to. So I was very, very excited to showcase those places. And we didn't win Hometown Heroes, but it got me started. So I'm very grateful for that. And just the hometown of it all really, you know, got my imagination going.
And the principal actors, the performers, were they all from, were any of them from the area that you shot?
Most of our talent was from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Danny, I don't think we had anybody, we definitely didn't have anyone like super local, but we did have a few Michigan actors. Danny knew and brought on board.
Ricky Wayne was a local Michigan guy who kind of comes and goes from Michigan. And he plays the father in the movie. Wayne David Parker, who is just like a Michigan treasure in all of our eyes, that I had just been looking forward to work with for years. And I never got the opportunity to, he's kind of from the Purple Rose camp and, was part of a lot of Jeff Daniels movies and stuff. And so he came in and, for a day and just plays one giant scene in the movie. And he just does it exquisitely. The little boy in the movie, who's a non-hearing boy, was local as well. He was great. And that might be it. And then, yeah, Libe, our lead, was from New York, and everyone else was pretty much Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Did you say that's about right, Anna? Am I remembering all that right?
Yes. And when I first met Libe, she was in LA and then she moved to New York.
Okay.
Yeah. That's not the most important thing.
So when you're bringing your performers to the area, like I said, I very much feel like I knew these people, like these were all people that I grew up with. How did you describe the setting to them to inform these characters? Or did you describe this to them, or did you let them interpret it themselves?
I definitely described... I mean, I described the area to them. And, you know, I referred to it as like a smaller lake community. And it's, you know, fairly affluent. But really, we just worked on the characters themselves and where they came from. So little details of like who they were in high school, and who they are now. I believe in this script, I describe one of the characters, Dylan, as peaked in high school and knows it.
Okay.
And his girlfriend, Kennedy, peaked in high school and doesn't know it. So I always go back to the text. I start with the text, obviously. But I really think casting, our casting process was a little tricky. Me and Danny basically did it all with the help of some like friends who were agents, our talents agents and managers who just wanted to make the project as best as it could be. And I spent a lot of time, on casting and saying no to a lot of people. And I do believe that like 80% of directing is casting. So it's very important to me that I took the time to get these characters right. Hmm. I also think for Libe and Ariella, who play the two sisters, they spent so much time with me. And I was like, I am these people from this town.
Mm-hmm.
And they would read some of the parts and they'd be like, this sounds like you. They're like, I've heard this kind of thing before from you, or I've been around your friends and I've heard this. So spending time with me, even in Los Angeles, I think helped inform those characters. I hope that answers your question.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it was kind of a very open-ended question to begin with. So thank you. When was it shot?
Oh, real quick. I want to add, all of the cast, so we had a crew house and we had a cast house, and they were both on lakes.
Mm-hmm.
They were both lake houses. And that's just because those were the houses available for rent in the area. So I think there was a little bit of method acting in there where they got to kind of hang out on the lake for a minute. So yeah, wanted to add that.
How long were you, when was it shot? How long were you in the area?
We shot this in 2019.
Mm.
And it was over the course of 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I don't know, Danny, it's all a blur.
Yeah, a little more than 3 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like in the fall, August, like right at the end.
Mm-hmm, August, September.
Mm-hmm. What did they think of the area? How do you think that the area in influenced them?
For the talent.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them had been to Michigan before. Except for the people from Michigan. Yeah. But our talent, when they got there, I remember Libe just saying like, this is so beautiful. Like the sky is so beautiful. Like the colors, like it's so vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I, went to live in LA, I remember the first time that I came back to Michigan and we were like flying over into DTW. And I looked out the window and I was like, oh my God, it's so green. Like it's so green. You see lakes and you're like, they're so blue. And LA isn't as bright environmentally. So I think they were really taken aback at the beauty and the intimacy of the areas that we did this in.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk, there's a lot, the film has to do with the Libe, her character studies speech and sign language. I want to know what your experience with that expertise. Did you study speech and sign language to write this film, or was it something that you had already, that you pulled from your own experience as well?
I don't have a background in American Sign Language, and I haven't been previously involved with the deaf community.
Mm-hmm.
How it came about was I was exploring language, like literally languages. So the short film deals with speech disfluencies, which are interruptions in the smooth flow of speech, which are anything from like, pauses, utterances, restarting sentences, and filler words that we focus on, like but like, and we explore sorry as one of those filler words that we kind of throw into sentences. And I do want to say that the term disfluency is largely associated with stuttering specifically, but we do have normal speech disfluencies that we all use. So how I came to be interested in disfluencies is after my experience, I found myself apologizing a lot or throwing sorry into sentences. And I was like, what is going on? What is this called? And I just started doing a little research on it. And that was the framework for the short. For the feature, I was like, I want to expand upon this. How can we explore communication and language even more? So I was looking at different languages. I was like, oh, is this going to be, two people communicating through you know, Spanish or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, English and Spanish, like people that don't share the same language or teaching one another about communication. And sign language came up and I didn't know much about it. And I looked into it and it is such a beautiful language. You feel what you're saying because you're moving with it. I really believe a lot in the body in terms of communication, not just body language, but like how you feel when you're expressing certain things. So sign language was really, really cool. And I started learning more about it and I started, talking to people in the deaf community and just doing research and having lots of conversations. And I landed on, yes, this is the way that I think we should go for this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It comes at a moment where we're seeing the representation of the non-hearing community in a lot of terrific ways, of course, CODA. And then there's an Oscar short that this year, one of the documentary short, I believe it's called Audible, is about a non-hearing a football team in Maryland. That's really great. Did the performers know anything about sign language? I know Libe and I don't recall the actress's name, the mother in the film. Did they have any experience with sign language?
No, our actresses didn't have a background in sign language, but they were both coached and worked with Stephanie Nagyurov, who is a deaf actress and a deaf ASL consultant coach. She actually read our script and gave me notes because I wanted it to be, you know, as a screenwriter and a director and a storyteller, it's my responsibility to make sure that these communities are represented accurately and are approved by these communities as much as possible. And seeking out experts in research, advice, consulting was a big part of it. We also had deaf consultants on set who were like at the monitor watching the scenes to make sure that all the sign language was correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the local folks were David and Debbie Deitch, and they're a married couple and they're both deaf in varying degrees. David was born deaf and Debbie kind of became deaf over time and had marginal little bits of hearing. But David was completely non-hearing. So it was really interesting having the two of them on set together, kind of like tag teaming and sitting with the actresses at lunch and stuff like that, and just kind of going through things. And it was something that was really important to Anna and all of us that we really honored the deaf community and did it as authentically as possible. So it was a really cool thing to kind of see bloom on set.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten any response or reaction from the deaf community?
I honestly haven't been able, because we've shown Disfluency mostly at festivals so far, we haven't gotten a lot of eyes on it just yet. But Stephanie and a few other people have watched it and responded well to it.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was filmed in 2019 and then, stuff happened in 2020 and all that. What was it like? Were you editing it mostly throughout 2020, 2021?
Oh boy. Yeah. we did a lot of remote editing. Kevin Baru, who's also a University of Michigan alum and now a New York based editor. Mm-hmm. Me and him worked remotely, shared screen for all of this basically. And we did end up doing a pickup shoot in fall of 2020.
Okay.
In LA during COVID, which was very challenging. But we did it and we did it very safely. And it came out beautifully. I'm so, so grateful for everyone that was involved and we continued editing. So having the amount of time that we did to edit, because we had extra time, we were really able to like go over everything, like pick and choose performances. And I do want to say that we needed it because of the remoteness of it. Yeah. We got in the groove and it worked out beautifully. Kevin's a rock star.
Yeah. I mean, when COVID hit and lockdown went down, the film industry definitely had no idea what to do in terms of production. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more beyond just production that went awry in the film industry, but for production, I know like Jurassic Park was one of the films that was right in the middle of shooting. And a lot of people look to them as kind of like, well, what do we do here? And so they shut down for 2 days, put what I heard was about $6 million into their COVID budget, reopened and were awesome. And they were just like this rock star movie that managed to do it and do it safely. And so there was a lot of stuff in the industry. There's a paper called the White Papers that came out, and it was basically a collaboration between all the unions into what they saw as safe practices to keep film shooting. But I mean, that all said, everyone was learning along with the rest of the world on what this was and how it was going to affect people's safety on set. And so for us, a tiny little film, the tricky thing is like a lot of the safety stems from testing and stuff like that. And testing was especially in 2020 was so expensive. Yeah. When you're talking about like, you know, even our crew is pretty small. Like we're talking 30, 35 people plus a cast. And like, but if you're looking at $100, $150 a head every single day, it blooms into tens of thousands of dollars very, very, very quickly. So what we ended up doing was for the pickup shoot in Los Angeles, which a lot of it was kind of near Dodger Stadium. We would put our call times every morning at Dodger Stadium. So the whole cast and crew would show up for their call time in the morning at Dodger Stadium, which for people that don't know in LA was a massive COVID testing site, and it was all governmentally backed. So there was no cost involved. So the whole cast and crew would just roll up with their cars, get their noses swabbed, and then just go straight to set and shoot for the day. And we started that a couple of days early because at that time it was still about that 24 to 48 hour turnaround on the PCR tests. And so, yeah, so it became this little weird assembly line that everyone would go through every day to get their testing done and be safe. And so through that, we were able to dodge the costs on the testing. And then we had our COVID compliance officer on set. Hans Afar was just awesome. And he's, you know, a former EMT and FEMA trained and like, just like a really, really like sharp individual and had infectious disease backgrounds and degrees in this stuff. And so for a little indie, it was just so, so important to us that, you know, despite the fact that we didn't necessarily have much money to work with, that we really, really managed to keep people safe. And yeah, I was pretty proud of that. Like we managed to like get through it, which was crazy, but it happened. And so that was a good thing for all.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's incredible. I think so now the film, we're playing it at the Michigan Theater on Tuesday, March 8th at 7:30. And you're both going to be there, correct?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Oh yeah. We'll be there.
And I'm so glad that we're able to do this in a safe space and capacity. Obviously, I think that your goal now is just to make sure that the film is out there and is seen by as many as you can. What are the future release plans for this? Do you have any other dates, screening dates planned?
We're currently in our spring festival run. This mm-hmm. will be kind of like the tail end of our run here, or the second half, I should say, second half of our run. So we're really focused on that. We are in conversations about distribution. I really hope and do believe the film will be available to stream later this year. So mm-hmm. that's my goal for it. We'll hopefully have a little theatrical release, and yeah.
And but before we wrap it up here, do you have anything that you're currently working on that you'd like to plug, that you'd like to get out there into the ether?
Right now, I'm working on getting this baby out there. So that's yeah. been my primary focus. Mm-hmm. Focusing on just my writing career and seeing what the next steps will be for that.
Yeah, I'm always juggling some stuff. I'll be shooting a movie out in Massachusetts in about a month and a half, 2 months. So that'll be fun. And then have another movie too that I'm also directing as well. That's coming down the pike for later this year. That's fun. But yeah, always juggling. Just really excited to keep cruising through the festival run this spring with Fluency and just riding that wave. Ever since it won Austin back in October, it's kind of just been this really special little gem that people are kind of perking up to on the festival circuit. And that's just been such a blessing to kind of cruise with. So it's been great.
Absolutely. Best of luck on all your endeavors. Thank you so much for hopping on the podcast with me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And I appreciate it.
That was a terrific conversation I had with the creators of DeFluency. I want to again thank Anna Baumgarten and Danny Mooney for giving me their time. Again, if you want to see their film, it is playing Tuesday, March 8th at 7:30 p.m. in the Michigan Theater Historic Auditorium. You can be there and ask any questions that you think that I missed live and in person. And once again, thank you for listening to participate in future roundtable discussions I hope to be doing on Facebook Live. Follow the Michigan and State Theater on our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find us at Michigan Theater and at State Theater A2, and that is theater spelled with an R-E. Of course, in the meantime, be sure to subscribe and give the podcast a rating so we can catch more listeners. Thank you to Matt Gauntlet and the Ann Arbor District Library for making sure these episodes drop on their feed. To email the show with topic suggestions or to send us your movie magic moments or comments, you can reach us at btmpod@gmail.com. The theme you're listening to right now is Keith Mansfield's Morning Broadway, a classic library catalog recording. Thank you for listening and joining us behind the marquee.